Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today, I'll be reading from the May 2024 issue of the AA Grapevine. We will have three parts this month for the Grapevine, and our first section is about how the steps changed my life. Let's get started. And our first story is entitled, Steps to Freedom. After 35 years of living in the steps, he gratefully recalls how much better life is. I was never a social drinker. The first time I got drunk was on my 17th birthday in June of 1978. It was my first blackout. I was an instant alcoholic. A month later, my oldest brother Bill was killed in a car accident. With a pain-filled, heavy heart, I attempted to drown my sorrows. I tried to drink him away. When I started my senior year of high school, I went from being a book-smart, extremely shy kid who was afraid of girls to the boy who drank way too much. Later, I was suspended for having whiskey in a soda bottle at the basketball game. When I got my senior picture taken, the photographer told me I looked like I had a hangover, which I did, one that would have killed a bear. After high school, many of my friends went off to college. I received my higher education at the University of Beer and Whiskey. I stayed drunk for the next few years. I blacked out all the time and never liked it when my friends would say, "I saw you the other night, and boy, were you ever drunk." I drove in that drunken condition, even though my brother had been killed in a car accident. Yet when I finally got to AA and saw Step 2, I was foolish enough to think I didn't need to be restored to sanity. Finally, in December of 1983, after a particularly rough weekend binge of blackout drinking, I asked myself, "Has it come to this? What kind of a person have I become?" Wanting to live, I called the AA hotline. They took my number and said an AA member would call me back. A little while later, a man named Wally, who I still see at meetings, called me back and got me to my first AA meeting. Right away, I learned that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. I also learned that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. So I sought God. From that day forward, I started to ask God to give me strength to stay sober each day. Then I thanked him at night. I've not had a drink since I started saying those prayers. But that was about the only thing I did right. I went to one meeting a week. Being a loner, I didn't trust anyone or make any AA friends. I got a sponsor, but never called him. Shortly thereafter, he moved away. 8 or 9 years passed, and I still wasn't drinking, but I was sure restless, irritable, and discontent. I would hear the fourth and fifth steps read at meetings, and I think I could never do that. It seemed like at every meeting I attended, step four was discussed. One day, I asked a guy named Mustache Jim to be my sponsor. He guided me through the fourth and fifth steps. He got me to list all my resentments and fears and review my sex life. I aired the worst skeletons in my closet. It was a liberating experience. I've struggled at times with the sixth and seventh steps. I learned I was prideful, arrogant, selfish, self-centered, and overly sensitive. I often have feelings of superiority and inferiority. I can also be an egomaniac with low self-esteem. I once asked a fellow AA member, "How does one become entirely ready to have God remove their defects?" He said it was just like when we first came to AA and were ready to have the drink problem removed. In the same way, we can be entirely ready to have God remove these other issues. It's been a real adventure doing the steps. I've had many experiences. Once on a ninth step, I called my old high school friend Joe to confess that I stolen from him and lied about it. I hadn't even thought about it for 25 years, yet I still felt guilty. I really needed to pray for courage, to God for courage, before I made that phone call. One time, when I was first practicing my 10th step, I had to apologize at my home group to a fellow AA. I'd made an obscene gesture to him, and he said something which I took offense at. I apologized to him and told him I was wrong. Later, I found out that his oldest son had died the day before. For the 11th step, I try to visit my church every day to improve my conscious contact with God. I talk to him as a friend, to a friend, and as a son, and to a father. I ask for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. One time on a 12-step call, a guy who had been drinking took a rifle out from under his bed and put it in his mouth. My friend and 12-step partner Dick grabbed it and took it away from him before anything happened. The man eventually died of this disease. He had been in and out of AA for years. Sometimes 12-step work is tough. I'm so fortunate I grew up in AA. I came in when I was 22, and now I'm 57. In sobriety, I went to college and earned an associate's degree and then a bachelor's degree. I met a girl, got engaged, and got married sober. Both my parents died while I was in AA, and I stayed sober then too. Our firstborn, a son, was stillborn, and I stayed sober. Later, we had two daughters, Jennifer, now 20, and Stephanie, 19, who have never seen their father drink. AA's program of recovery is a design for living that works when the going gets rough and when things are good. This came from the steps. Instead of being a distrustful loner, I now get to show up and reach out to others. God and AA have truly done for me what I could not do for myself. Signed, Jim M. in Cadillac, Michigan. And our next story is entitled, A Question of Sanity. A newcomer gets a little higher power logic to help him find his way to step two. I came into AA as the prototypical agnostic. I didn't know if there was a God or there wasn't, and I didn't care. Not that I gave the matter much thought. I had my priorities, don't you know? I was a religious mongrel, a little Jewish, some Lutheran, with a heavy dollop of Southern Baptist. So my concept of God was quite confused. Right away, it was obvious that I couldn't go far into the steps without addressing this higher power issue. That turned out that not to be a problem, as there was a whole chapter in the Big Book just for me titled We Agnostics. I like how the chapter starts with as an accurate definition of an alcoholic as you will find anywhere in the Big Book. Quote, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Yep, that's me. But then comes the veiled threat. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Followed by the absolute threat. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Oh no, I thought. I'm doomed. I shared my dismay in a meeting, and afterward this old-timer came up to me. Not so fast, he said. If you have honestly taken the first step, you've already have a power greater than yourself. Huh? I replied. You admitted that you're powerless over alcohol, right? He said. So alcohol is a power greater than yourself. Simply call alcohol your lower power. Do you suppose there could be anything higher than a lower power? Yeah, well, I guess so, I replied. There, he said, that's all you need to get started. Turn your will and your life over to whatever that is, and you're on your way. I thought about that. So now I'm on step three, I asked. Not so fast, he said. You still have to come to believe that this power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. Do you think you're insane? No problem there, dude, I replied. I have a certifiable mental illness with suicide attempts and stays in the psych ward. Wrong, replied the old-timer. Read the story of Jim in Chapter 3. What does it say about the definition of insanity? I don't know, I replied, puzzled. Well, of course you don't, he said. Go read those pages. So I went home and read about Jim. He had been 12-stepped and was sober for a few months when he stopped at a restaurant for a sandwich and a milk. Still hungry, he ordered another sandwich and a milk, but this time he decided to put an ounce of whiskey in the milk as it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that he ordered another and another. This started one more trip to the asylum for Jim. However, the sentence that really jumped out at me was on the next page. Quote, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. I returned to that old-timer and told him what I found, and he said, so, where drinking is concerned, do you think you're insane? Well, when I was drinking back in the 1980s, I had a lot of stomach problems, I explained, and I read that taking an ounce of antacid every 2 hours would help. That seemed like a lot of antacid, and I was kind of busy, so I mixed an ounce of vodka in my antacid and drank it every, well, not that I really timed myself. You're kidding, the old-timer said. No, I replied, that's the God's honest truth. Sheesh, and I thought away. And I thought I was bad, he said. and walked away. Signed, Robert P. in Amity, Oregon. This story is entitled, The Road to Joy. Though he got a late start, he luckily made the right turn. Boy, is life better now. Where's the road to true joy, and how do I find it? I would ask myself. That road was staring me in the face for nearly 24 years before I saw it. And it took a few more years before I actually got on it. Dr. Bob pointed us all toward it when he summed up our program in three words, love and service. It wasn't that I was unhappy in my sobriety or that I wasn't doing service. I've actually been sober since 1982, and my life in AA has been a vast improvement over my drinking years. An early mentor of mine in AA once told me that I could have a slice of joy in sobriety, or I could have the whole pie. The choice was mine. Much depends on whether I decide to commit to be a person of service or a person who gets by on performing just a little. Both paths improve my life, but one gets me a bigger piece of joy. One of the founders of my home group always talked about our 12 steps. It took me forever to figure out what he was saying. This guy was all about action. Our group had a plaque on the front of our podium that read, Gratitude is an attitude, and he used to tell me all the time that it didn't apply to guys like us. Gratitude is an action, he'd say. Don't tell me you're grateful. Show me. He showed his gratitude by being of service in AA out in his community. The steps aren't just for me to study or work, he told me. They are there for me to take into my soul, to become part of me and shape the very essence of my existence. I believe now that the steps are the soul of the program and meetings are the heart. I balked at taking the steps early in sobriety. I was afraid of what they might change me into. Even though I was pretty miserable back then, at least my misery was familiar. I was fearful of entering into unknown territory, even if it might benefit me. When the gift of desperation became too much for me, I relented and began taking the steps in earnest. Finally, I realized taking the steps was not work. The steps are my admission ticket back into society. The process of taking the steps prepares me to fulfill my purpose of being of maximum service, and eventually, that work turns into joy. Signed, Harold I. in Marietta, Georgia. This story is named, And When We Were Wrong. A member expresses his love for the steps, especially the one where we clean things up and keep our mouths shut. The book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions opened up a new window to my spirituality, especially in regard to Step 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. At first I thought it said, if we were wrong, but I soon learned otherwise. The essay that Step 10 has been particularly helpful to me in its descriptions of restraint of tongue and pen, and the value of ongoing personal inventories. As a new member of AA, I thought I should display my razor-sharp, foul-mouthed wit whenever I shared at a meeting. After one such display, an elegant gentleman, who later became a dear friend, pulled me aside and said that he didn't mind when a man spoke like I had just had if he couldn't express himself any other way. But I could, and yet I didn't. And that's why what I said had bothered him. I gulped and recognized that what he had said was the truth. Another time I went on an obscene tirade at a young people's AA meeting. After the meeting, a man approached me and explained that he visits with his 13-year-old daughter every other weekend, and that night he brought her to an AA meeting. Then he hit me with the clincher, and I'm really sorry she had to listen to you tonight. His statement led me to yet another gulp, so I began to change my behavior and the way I spoke at AA meetings. The great American satirist Ambrose Bierce defined apologize as to lay grounds for a future offense. My apologies and hollow promises to change were staples of my drinking days. Get drunk, engage in outrageous antics, wake up the next day with a massive hangover, make the rounds groveling, apologizing, and voicing my intention to never do that again. Eventually, my family and friends recognized that my words were empty, and they started to pay attention to my behavior. People are much more interested in my changed actions than my dreary apologies. A few months ago, I had inadvertently embarrassed a man during a meeting at work, but I didn't realize what I had done until the meeting was over. I could have apologized to him privately, but the offense occurred publicly, so the apology deserved to be made in publicly also. At the next week's meeting, I apologized to him in front of the entire room and began treating him more respectfully. One time before I was to speak at a large AA meeting, the man who spoke before me said something that set me up to make a devastatingly funny joke. I knew it would be funny because I had done the same thing to another man at another meeting, and the meeting hall erupted in laughter at his expense. This time, I kept my big, fat, allegedly funny mouth shut, despite craving the laughter that I knew would have ensued. Biting my tongue was not a skill I learned easily, but I believe in that old adage, it's better to be silent and thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. A year or so ago, I spent $1,000 on car repairs. The next evening, the car started acting up again. I stewed during much of the night and seriously considered leaving a message on the auto repair shop's voicemail about how, if they didn't fix it, I would report them to the Bureau of Automotive Repair and leave a bad review on their website. Luckily, I didn't do any of that. In the morning, I brought my car to the shop and was pleasant and kept my mouth shut. The mechanic examined the car, and it was a simple fix. I went on my happy way that I hadn't ruined a relationship with an auto repair resource and continued to provide me with good service. Of the many benefits of continued self-appraisal and efforts to change my behavior is that it buys me a few extra seconds before I bark at someone, and I haven't barked at anyone in a long time. One preventative acronym I often employ is WAIT, short for Why Am I Talking? It can be way too much of a blowhard at times. I recall that Abraham Lincoln had a habit of writing letters to people who he had conflicts with, placing the letters under his pillow and destroying them the next day. When I receive troublesome emails, most of which do not require an immediate response, I draft a response, save it, and return to it later for editing. This practice has saved me and many other people a lot of grief by not angrily pressing the send button right away. Once I had a dust-up with a boss and felt threatened with disciplinary action, which she did not pursue. I considered consulting with our human resources office, but decided not to. I kept my head down and worked hard. Many months later, at a company event, the boss pulled me aside, gave me a hug, and apologized for her behavior. Shortly thereafter, she gave me a highly laudatory performance review, along with the highest merit raise possible that year, so that I was making more money than I'd ever made in my life. More importantly, our relationship was repaired. Again, I'm certain that restraint, painstakingly taught to me by many AA members over the years, had come to the rescue. I also make it a practice to attend an annual or semi-annual AA retreat for some personal house cleaning. This allows me to see what progress I have or haven't made. I view such an exercise as akin to driving. When driving, I have a big open windshield to see where I'm going. I also have a small rearview mirror to see what's behind me. I think that's the proper proportion for me, so I don't wander morbidly around in the past. Our 12 and 12 has had a tremendously positive effect on my personal recovery program, especially the chapter on step 10. I can only encourage those who are not familiar with this gem to take a good look at it. Signed, Paul C. in Oceanside, California. Our next story is entitled, Beyond What I Imagined, How the Steps Helped Her Become More Patient, Tolerant, Authentic, Useful, and Right-Sized. My sobriety date is April 8, 2015. I had gone to rehab 4 years earlier, but I wasn't ready to stop yet. Back then, I was still drinking wine in a glass at home with my husband, not vodka in a travel mug alone hiding in my car. Finally, alcohol had me on my knees in front of the toilet, again, at 4:45 a.m. It was winter, and where we live, it was already dark at 4:45 in the afternoon. The only way I knew whether it was morning or afternoon was if my husband was asleep next to me in our bed. That morning, between dry heaves, I checked my phone. There were 10 missed calls from my daughter from the day before. She was crying and screaming into the phone that I had forgotten to pick her up from school. Again. The alcohol clearly wasn't working for me anymore, yet I kept going back to it. Why? All I ever wanted was to be perfect. Perfect at work, the perfect homemaker, and a perfect mom. But there was no perfection in this behavior. I had risen to the top of my profession, had a beautiful home, a loving husband, and a wonderful daughter. And then, what started as a bit of a drinking problem to alleviate stress and anxiety very quickly spiraled down until I hit my bottom. So I crawled back into AA and surrendered what I hoped was for good this time. By the grace of God, AA, and great sponsorship, I got sober and worked my first three steps to the best of my ability. My fourth step was a gunny sack full of resentments. As I did my fifth step, my eyes began to open. Everything suddenly looked different. I saw that I had been in a pit of self-absorbed pity. I had become a martyr. I had been living my life to be fiercely independent, to make my own way. My resentments and defects were my motivation and my fuel. I always had something to prove, to be the best, and it worked for a while. With willingness and a modicum of humility, I was now sober and living in recovery. And most importantly of all, AA helped me find God, a God I thought I neither wanted nor needed. I believe my spiritual awakening began when I read the first sentence of our seventh-step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I had never read or heard anything like that before in my life. Who would want all of me? I thought I had to be perfect for anyone to want me. After reading that prayer, I saw my part in all my resentments. I could see how I wasn't victimized by my alcoholism, nor by all those people on my resentment list. I was victimized by my own perception, most of which is made up of my character defects. It was self-inflicted pain. The world and the people in it weren't going to change. The change would have to come from me. The sixth and seventh steps were real game changers. The principles of willingness and humility, along with honesty, integrity, hope, courage, love, and service, became my instruction manual of how, with God's help, I could best be rid of my most devastating defects: anger, inferiority, regret, self-pity, resentment, dishonesty, and ego. I had been living in my character defects for so long, I didn't realize I was punishing myself. Luckily, God's help in the form of sponsoring other women, here I learned patience, tolerance, empathy, and true love. When practicing these assets, there isn't much room for defects. I also saw that no matter how far down the scale these women had gone, they were human, and their stories made them complicated and multidimensional. I learned from my mistakes that some of my biggest failures could benefit others. And mostly I realized that this ideal of perfection was really a billion little defects wrapped up in sheep's clothing. Only now in recovery do I see that perfection is my biggest defect of all. There is no humility in perfection, only pride and ego and self-pity. Through these steps, I've truly gained the new freedom and a new happiness in our ninth step promises talk about. And in step 10, when it talks about our reaction to alcohol, how we recoil from it as from a hot flame, that's what began to happen to me. And with God's help, I sought through prayer and meditation, as the 11th step suggests. I asked for the right thought or action, not so others would like me better, but because most of my glaring defects, self-pity, inferiority, and jealousy, stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. Using our step's spiritual principles as my instruction manual, I found myself becoming more authentic, not perfect, but closer to the person God had intended all along. And in doing so, I've remained sober, and I've been rewarded with relationships beyond what I could have asked for or imagined. Signed, Michelle B. in Kelowna, British Columbia. And that's all the time we have for today's AA Grapevine, May of 20. The meeting lists were made available by the local intergroup. The doors were open, the lights were on, the literature was out on the table. The message was shared by members and the coffee was brewing. There wasn't a thing I had to do, no dues or fees to pay. I could just walk in. They had everything I needed, especially the coffee. and boy did I drink it. I don't remember who made the coffee. I really can't remember their faces or their names. I do, however, remember drinking cup after cup as if my life depended on it. My entrance into AA makes me think about our 12th tradition, which states that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Today, I understand that this tradition teaches me to be a trusted servant, regardless of any recognition or merit. I don't seek validation for doing acts of service, lest I let my ego rear its head. Today, I must keep an attitude of gratitude, completing my acts of service as if my efforts will never be known or acknowledged. I must give back what was given to me. We do our AA service. We pay the rent on our facilities. We provide the literature, and we make sure the coffee is made so someone who hasn't yet found their bearing can just walk in and have a seat. I hope I can make the best cup of coffee possible for the next newcomer who walks through our doors. They may not remember my face, they may not remember my name, but maybe they'll remember that warm cup of coffee. To those who came before me and who made sure that the doors were open and the lights were on, I'd just like to say, thanks for the coffee. Signed, Connor D. in Austin, Texas. And that's all the time we have today for the May 2024 AA Grapevine. This was part one. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller, and I've been your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.